Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And we're speaking with Charles Wilkinson, Principal for Human Resource Management Incorporated out of Birmingham, Alabama, and yes, a very good friend. Charles, how are you today?
I'm great, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing great. Well, you know, we haven't had you on for a little while, and there's been so many things that have changed for federal contractors and subcontractors that I said, you know what, I've got to put you back on. I have to.
Well, a lot's happened in the past year. Many of the things we talked about last time were proposed regulations, and some of those things have come to fruition, and some of them aren't quite as bad as we thought they could be. Some things, still keep us awake at night, but plenty to talk about in this year that's passed.
Well, great. Well, let's get into it here, shall we? I think where I'd like to start is because, obviously, a lot of what you do and certainly we do together has to do with affirmative action plans for, you know, federal contractors, subcontractors that do work. And the OFCCP has changed some guidelines. They were proposed, at one time. Now they're coming to fruition. Talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening with the guidelines on employment with veterans, and of course the guidelines on employment of individuals with disabilities. You can take each one independently.
In terms of employment of individuals with disabilities, that's covered under Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And basically, if you're a federal contractor or a subcontractor, you have obligations to not only employ individuals with disabilities, but if you have them employed, it's to advance them in employment, offer them the same training and development opportunities and, of course, reasonable accommodations to be able to do the essential functions of the job. And so none of the underlying premises of that has really changed. What has changed is really the heavy-handedness is the way that I best describe it, that we have the obligations that have really not changed, but they're really being very prescriptive in how we go about that now, where for the first time, seeing specific goals that have to be set for individuals with disabilities in each of our job groups. And so if you're a federal contractor, you're very familiar with this term, job groups, which is basically just a combination of jobs that theoretically have something in common. They're similarly situated, and typically you'll have management categories, professional categories, technical, sales, craft positions, maybe laborers and service. And what the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs is saying is that in these new regulations, you have to have goals for individuals with disabilities in each of those job groups. If your workforce is over 100, it has to be per job group. If you're less than 100 in the workforce, you can have the goals for the entire workforce.
Now, when you talk about goals, because I think that somebody would say, is this a quota?
Well, they're very quick to point out these are not quotas, meaning that you don't have to achieve them over any certain period of time and may not ever achieve them. And I think a lot of folks in the community that serves individuals with disabilities, they'll tell you that it's probably going to be hard for every contractor to meet that goal just because of the population of individuals who have disabilities that are job ready. But there are services out there that provide that. But no, so they're not quotas. They're goals. They're benchmarks to achieve through some good faith effort. Doing the best that we can to achieve those. And I mentioned the 7% goal. That's the national goal. And there's basically two options here. One is you can set this 7% placement goal, which is the national goal, or you do have the option of setting a goal based on more localized data if it's available. But I think that's going to be a struggle for organizations. And the other thing is that it's requiring outreach. It used to be called linkage agreements, formal agreements with organizations who serve the disability community, and having a formal written agreement with them on referring jobs and trying to interview. They've changed that now to just outreach efforts, but most of these organizations are nonprofit. They're staffed by volunteers, and what we fear is that there's going to be an overrun of these organizations. They're not going to be able to support the demand that's dictated by the government for the federal contractors.
I want to back up for just a second, if I can, because I think someone listening would say to themselves, they'd say, okay, I guess I understand they're going to set these limits and they're going to say that, oh, these goals, and that somebody needs to achieve it. But I, as the HR professional, I, as the business owner, I don't want to know, don't need to know, can't ask my employees if they're disabled, or does this change that?
Well, it does change that, and this was another big area of concern for federal contractors because, as you know, in HR, for so many years, really since the Americans with Disabilities Act came on the scene, we've coached ourselves and trained ourselves and our managers, don't ask about disability. We don't want to know. We can't know. And if someone in an interview raises that subject and starts to tell us something we should know, we're to steer them away from that, tell them, don't go there, it's not relevant to the job, and we focus our conversations around, you know, any accommodations that may be needed to do the job. This changes that in a significant way. Heretofore, we could only solicit information about race and gender prior to an offer of employment, so that we were not allowed to ask about disability status. These new regulations tell us that we have to ask about disability status and veteran status pre-offer, which means at the time they fill out their employment application and they complete the voluntary disclosure of their race and gender, we have to ask them now about their disability status and veteran status. The good thing about that is that the government, the OFCCP, is going to give us the language to use, and if we use that language, we have a safe harbor, so to speak, in terms of, you know, a challenge coming from us knowing that information. So several things about that disclosure changes. One, now we have to ask it pre-offer. The other thing is that within the first year that we're subject to these new regulations, we have to poll our workforce to find out their disability status, which is a big departure. We just have not needed to know unless somebody raised the issue of an accommodation. So now, within the first year, we have to poll our workforce on their disability status, and then subsequently at 5-year intervals we have to resurvey our workforce. And then the thought behind that is basically that disability status can change over time, and someone who may not be disabled now may be disabled at some point in the future, and that gives them an opportunity to disclose that. You know, I guess the good thing about that is with having a goal and this solicitation requirement now, the other thing that's changed is that in 503, there was a different definition of a disability that was inconsistent with the ADA definition of a disability. So these are now the same. The Rehabilitation Act has adopted the ADA definition of a disability. So I guess the good thing there is that there's more to disclose now, and we hear over and over that, you know, virtually everyone now has some disability. It's just going to be a matter of, do they feel comfortable disclosing it? Because, you know, just like we've been trained not to talk about it, so have they. You know, but I think there's fear that what's going to happen if I disclose a disability. And I think it may take some time for our workforce to figure out it's okay to do that, and that we have a necessary need to know now.
You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, one of the things that I immediately think about is employers, I've always said it, I'll continue to say, want to do the right thing. And there is this hesitation by HR, hesitation by owners to collect this data. So can you provide information for them to say, hey, you know, you've probably collected other data having to do with, you know, age and gender and everything. Do you recommend that somebody who doesn't do the hiring collect that data and that goes somewhere else? I mean, how do we do a realistic rollout of this new information that needs to be collected?
Well, that's a good point. Many organizations who have an online application, it's solicited at the time of the application in an electronic system, and often those will be able to route a resume through the system, say, to HR, to a hiring manager, without that information tagging along. So you want to make sure if you're collecting it in an electronic system or in a paper application where it's just a single page attached to the application, that is detached from there before it's routed through the organization to anyone who may be making a hiring decision. Now, I've often had the question, you know, who in HR needs to see that information? Do we need to protect it from the recruiters? And I would say that, you know, if you can't trust your recruiters or HR with this information, they have every other piece of information, then you've got a bigger problem. So I think anybody in HR that's involved in the recruitment selection process can be privy to this information. Of course, you'd need to be, you know, reasonably comfortable that they're not using it in the employment decision, because that's the other big caveat, that even though we're collecting this information, we can't use it for anything other than the reporting obligations that we have. We can't use it as part of the selection decision. And certainly, no hiring manager or anyone outside HR should be privy to that information, and it should be filed separately from the employment application for anyone who has access to it that's not in HR.
So, all right, we've collected the information. HR has put it aside. They're not looking at it. They hire the person. We go through the process. The employer is now collecting the data. Tell me some of the things that they may have not thought of that they need to now collect having to do with disabilities. Do they have to break down the disabilities, the type, or is it just total numbers? I guess I want to dig a little bit deeper to try to make it so that listeners understand how in-depth this is.
Well, basically, again, we'll get the language we'll use from the federal government. It's not released yet, but it's going to be very generic in nature on the pre-offer solicitation. So it'll just be basically a disclosure that they have a disability. It's not going to give us detailed information. We don't really need that at that stage. We just need to know, are they a covered individual with a disability that would be counted under the affirmative action plan? Post-offer, we're able to get into discussions about reasonable accommodation. So you won't be collecting a lot of detailed information about the disability status at this point. Now, when we spoke a year ago, part of the proposed regulations was going to put placement goals on specific types of disabilities, not just disability in general, but they were going to do sub-goals of 2% for people that had complete hearing loss or hearing impairment or mobility impairments or vision impairment, some very severe disability status. And so that went away in the final regs. And so we're not now focused any at all on sub-disabilities at all. It's just disability, yes or no, very generically disclosed. But there's some other data requirements that are put on us in terms of the applicant flow data, not just the disability status up front, but these linkage organizations or these referral sources that we spoke about earlier, organizations who serve the disabled community, we now have to start tracking our referrals from those organizations. So if we reach out and partner with an organization, we post our jobs with that organization, we solicit their help to identify individuals with a disability who may be able to do our positions, perform our positions, we have to start tracking the referrals that we get from that organization, the number of applicants who self-identified themselves as having a disability, or in that case, being a protected veteran, the total number of job openings that we had, the total number of jobs that were filled, the number of applicants who were disabled that we hired, and the protected veterans who applied that we hired. So there's a lot of ratio analysis now that we'll have to do, very similar to what we're doing for women and minorities now. We'll have to start analyzing our selection ratios of individuals with disabilities and the efficiency or the effectiveness of our referral sources. And if they're not being very good partners to us, meaning that we're not getting good applicants that we're able to hire, then we're encouraged to go find other linkage partners to partner with.
One of the other regulations that came out you talked about was employments of veterans. A number of employers already do Vet 100's reports, which obviously talk about veterans in the workplace. Tell me a little bit how this differs in terms of the amount of information they need to collect, the difference with that information, and how it's reported.
Well, the Vets 100, we have two versions now, the 100 and the 100A, depending on the effective date of the contract. We're hearing that one of those may go away, the 100 may go away, because there are fewer and fewer contracts who have been around a long period of time that would predate the 100A. We're also hearing that, depending on how this affirmative action goes, the reporting could go away altogether. I doubt that sincerely, but basically the same obligations we just spoke about in terms of disabilities applies to the veterans. We still have to, we'll now have to solicit veteran status pre-offer versus the post-offer requirement before. We'll have to track the same sort of applicant statistics that we do for individuals with disabilities. The difference being that in the goal setting, we'll have to have goals for veterans as well. There's a national percentage of veterans in the civilian labor force at 8%, and that is the national goal that could, you know, that you could use to set for veterans workforce wide. It's not job group specific like the veteran. I mean the disability. So 7% goal on disability versus 8% national goal for veterans. The goal setting with veterans, you have the option of using your own benchmark data, which could be localized data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics or some other source to set your goal.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we'll be right back on News Talk WLOB.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're talking with Charles Wilkinson, Principal of Human Resource Management. We're having more fun than should be allowed. Hi, Charles.
Hi, David.
Are we having fun yet?
We are.
That's good. Just making sure. Because people sometimes say, wow, this is a lot for an employer to have to deal with, right? I mean, these are new things that just add more time and burden to an employer, an HR professional. Is there concern by the people that you talk to at, you know, different governmental levels that this is increasing the burden on employers?
It really is. And in many, many ways, it's funny. I asked someone the other day, what's the latest book they read? And they said, The Federal Register. And I think that's very funny, but it's so telling that, you know, we have to stay on top of these things. There's so much happening. And in this administration, it's on the, you know, the downhill slide the last 2 years of the administration, and there's so many things they're still trying to accomplish in the area of labor and employment. And we're seeing, just as we spoke about in the last segment, the affirmative action obligations. EEOC has been very, very active as an agency. They've really kind of ramped up and flexing their muscle in many, many ways as an agency, an enforcement agency, and they're working very closely with the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs and sharing information, cooperating on investigations and referring investigation or complaints between them. So, there's a double front there in terms of the Department of Labor.
Well, you're talking about the EEOC, and I think one of the things you mentioned is the fact that they have new guidelines on background checks. So talk a little bit about that, would you?
Well, I will. And of course, the EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and they are the enforcement agency that enforces Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And basically, it's the protected categories we've always heard, you know, race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, disability, and more recently, the genetic information. And they do the investigations. They take the complaints from individuals. And if you have 15 or more employees, you're covered by EEOC, and if you have 20 or more, you're covered by those age provisions. But recently, I guess it was about 18 months ago now, that they issued guidelines on the use of background screens. This was about April of 2012, and basically, you know, employers use criminal history checks very commonly. It's one of the very important steps in the selection process, but the EEOC has long presented these statistics that use of background screens may have an adverse impact on males and particularly minorities, African Americans. If you look at the statistics in terms of arrest rates and incarceration rates in prisons, that it does tend to be a higher percentage of males and minorities. And so they've outlined this, you know, based on that premise, these national statistics of arrests and convictions, that if you're using background checks, it does have the potential to be discriminatory under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And so they updated their policy regarding how employers should use this criminal history information. And it's really not a departure too much from their history and policies in this area. You know, they've always said that it's not illegal to use them, but if you find that there's adverse impact in the process, meaning that you have a practice like using a background screen and you find that more males or a higher percentage of males or minorities or anybody is being adversely affected by that policy, then it's called adverse impact. And you've got to look at a business necessity for that information, for using it.
When you're talking about background checks, one of the things that always come up is, well, you may have a credit check, you may have a drug screening check, you may have a personal history check. There's a whole bunch of different things that fall into these categories. Are there specific things that they're changing in the use of this, or is it all, or is it only partial?
Well, what they're saying is you can't have a blanket policy that says we're not going to hire anyone who's been arrested. We're not going to hire anyone who's got a felony conviction. What they're saying is that if you're going to use criminal background checks, you need to do three things, basically. Look at three things to justify that business necessity we spoke about a moment ago. The first thing is you've got to look at the nature of the offense or the gravity of the offense. How serious is it? And then the second thing is how much time has passed since that offense or conduct occurred or when they were sentenced, you know, the recency of it. And then the nature of the job that you're considering them for. So, for example, if you have a bank teller, it may be reasonable to pull a credit history on them because we hear over and over that if someone's having financial difficulties, there's a greater temptation to be dishonest. And likewise, if you have a truck driver, it's reasonable that you would want to pull a motor vehicle report to see if they have a clean driving record. And if they're collecting money from your customers, maybe a credit check would be reasonable. And then if they're delivering to a child daycare or assisted living facility where there are people who are vulnerable, maybe a sex offender check might be appropriate. So what they're saying is, you know, you just can't have a blanket policy. You need to look at the nature and the gravity of the offense, the time that's passed since the offense or conviction, and the type of position that you're considering them for.
Well, that all makes sense, really, at the end of the day, right? If you're saying that you want to make sure you're taking great care with this information and you're not just, you know, there is a gut feel sometimes of things you have to do when you're hiring somebody. And I think that employers and HR professionals do realize that it's not always cut and dry. Sometimes it is, but it's not always cut and dry, right?
Well, that's true. And I think, you know, as we pointed out that, you know, this clarification or statement of their new guidelines really is not a departure from their previous policies. What is different about all this is their discussion about disparate treatment, where basically they're saying there's basically two ways you can get into trouble with this. The first is that if we treat criminal history information for different applicants differently, for example, that bank teller example, if we pull credit checks on some applicants for tellers, maybe we pull it on minorities and females, but not our white males, then that is an adverse treatment. We're treating some groups of applicants differently than others for the same type of job. And then the other is this thing called adverse impact, where it's a neutral process, so we say we don't hire anybody with a felony conviction. But we find that, you know, the majority of our candidates who are falling out of the process because of that, or minority or male, is having an adverse impact on a group more so than, you know, maybe the other groups that may be in the applicant pool. So really, this disparate treatment is the discussion around that's very, very interesting. If you look at some of the litigation that they filed recently as an agency, it's kind of telling on that. It's almost as if they're investigating the use of criminal history checks by employers without any claims of adverse impact. And so it's almost as if our policy says or our guidelines say it's okay to use these background checks if you do these three things, nature and gravity, time that's passed, and the nature of the job. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing that it's almost if you're using them at all, there is a suspicion by the EEOC that something wrong is being done, and they're going after organizations for that. So the trend seems to be that, you know, people bringing these claims with the EEOC and even EEOC themselves taking them on as an agency, they're no longer required to point out the specific background check that or the specific policy that's being used inappropriately or that's having the adverse impact, but just the fact that you're using them at all. So it's got a lot of organizations revising their employment applications, their policies on background screens. We're seeing a lot of municipalities and states pass laws banning, they're called ban the box laws, where on the employment application has a box to check, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor, and you check the box. I mean, that box is being completely outlawed in some places.
You know, sometimes it just, there's a common sense thing that sometimes just appears to be missing. I mean, I certainly understand that there is a tendency and that there's potential adverse impact, but to an employer, to be in municipality, and just not look at anything that has to do with a person's history having to do with criminal behavior seems almost, and you can almost argue, you know, I should get an attorney on the line at some point, but, you know, you can almost argue that you're not doing your due diligence to protect the employer or the organization by not doing that.
Absolutely, and that is why most organizations do them. In some cases, it's actually required by law. School teachers, some public transportation workers, it's required by state or local or sometimes federal law. And so this seems to fly in the face of that and be contradictory. But most of the organizations who are doing background screens, they're doing them for a specific reason. They're not just doing them to spend money, because it can be a very expensive proposition. They're looking to make sure that their employees are protected from coworkers who may have issues from a criminal nature, or to protect the assets or property of the company or the customers, the employees, you know, safety and security. There's just a number of reasons why an organization would pull, you know, sexual misconduct, you know, drug convictions and job-related misdemeanors and just, you know, workplace violence. We see that over and over. So there are some legitimate reasons that are statutorily required and just good business practices. And then what happens when you don't pull the background screens? You're given, you know, the choice of, do I pull them and run the risk of a wrongful hire, or I introduce a problem into my workplace that causes me issues later, or do I run the risk of running afoul of the EEOC guidelines? So it's this Hobson's choice that a judge recently mentioned in one of his rulings. You know, which is the lesser of the two evils.
And, of course, it really is, of course, what each employer has to deal with and make those type of decisions. But it appears to me that sometimes common sense gets left out of these equations. And it can be frustrating to employers. I just can hear people on the, you know, the radio right now shaking their head. I mean, I just can just hear it.
Well, no doubt. And it's a sad statement, but often when you're dealing with the federal government and some of these rules and regulations, you know, common sense sometimes doesn't enter into the picture. You know, while it may be a noble goal to, and certainly it's in the purview of EEOC and it's their obligation to protect individuals from discrimination, but, you know, criminal history or having a criminal history is not a protected right under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. There's no federal statute that protects you in that sense. And so it's almost as if we're reaching, or they are reaching, to expand the scope of their enforcement purview, and they're looking at ways to do that through the background screens. And they've been very, very aggressive and very active in looking at this.
Well, there's no question they've been active, and there's no question that there have been changes and modifications being made in slow, subtle ways. I think, you know, the old statement of incrementalism, right? Incrementalism. you know, if you do it slowly and it doesn't seem like it's a big deal, then, you know, people just accept and move on. And in this particular case, there is some of that that is definitely happening at these levels, state and federal.
Well, it really is. And back in July of this year, after these guidelines were issued in April, of last year, having seen some of the litigation that's being brought by EEOC, the attorney generals in 9 different states joined together and took a stand against the EEOC guidelines on these use of criminal background checks. And I think it was Utah and West Virginia, South Carolina, Nebraska, Montana, Kansas, Georgia, Colorado, and Alabama, where I am. So they wrote a letter to the director of the EEOC and basically expressed their displeasure over this, and the statement that they felt that it was criticizing some of the litigation that had been brought under Title VII and saying that it was really off base to do that, and really challenging this assertion that a blanket criminal history policy has a disparate impact on African Americans or other minorities or males who may have higher conviction rates. They're taking issue with that. But to her credit, the director of EEOC wrote a very responsive rebuttal, if you will, is posted on the EEOC website, and did a very good job of reasserting that we're not saying that these are illegal or that you can't use them, but basically that you have obligations to use them properly, and not use just a bright line approach to these. So I think that there's still some bloodshed to be had in terms of what's ultimately going to happen with this. I think EEOC is going to continue to pursue this and look for some victories to prove their point. They've lost some cases recently. And so I think the heat is on both sides of that issue.
No question. And when we come back on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking to Charles about some of the most recent EEOC lawsuits, and he's going to tell us what has happened. We will be right back on News Talk WLOB.
Are you frustrated with medical care today? Does it make you angry that your doctor spends more time looking at the computer screen than at you? Does it seem like your doctor is out the door in 5 minutes? There is a better alternative. At Champy Family Practice, Dr. Michael Champy and his dedicated staff make taking care of patients their priority. They are a cash-friendly direct pay practice, which is the perfect option for people with no insurance, high deductibles, and health savings accounts. Unlike other practices, they post their prices in the office and even online. Get modern medical care delivered the old-fashioned way. For more information, call ChampyFamilyPractice.com. That's C-I-A-M-P-I. Or call 774-1222. Champy Family Practice is located at 380 Lincoln Street in South Portland. Champy Family Practice. Continuing a tradition of medical excellence in Greater Portland since 1959.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Charles Wilkinson, Principal of Human Resource Management Incorporated, and a good friend. We were talking last segment about the new EEOC guidelines. You have some EEOC lawsuits that you're going to tell us about that really have made a mark or a difference. So lay them out for us, Charles.
Okay. Well, I mentioned just a moment ago about the attorneys general in the 9 states that joined together to take that stand against the EEOC's guidelines on the use of background screens. And the 2 cases that really prompted that were EEOC lawsuits brought against Dollar General and BMW. Specifically, they were both accused of violating Title VII of the Civil Rights Act because they had a blanket approach, according to EEOC, based on criminal history. They would, had a bar set that if you had criminal histories, you would not be employed by the companies. And they articulated very good reasons for their policies. And both organizations felt like they had done nothing wrong, that, not wanting to hire individuals who had been convicted of rape or assault or child abuse or weapons violations or murders or drug convictions, that that was a legitimate interest of an employer to decide we're not going to employ those individuals. They weren't necessarily looking at arrest histories, but conviction histories, and this whole safety issue, public safety versus the safety of other employees and customers, and really an effort to minimize the risk of liability was kind of the reason why they looked at criminal backgrounds, and so EEOC took issue with that. And these cases are very interesting. There's a third one we'll talk about too. But basically, in the case of the BMW, there was of course a plant in Greenville, Spartanburg area, and they were using some subcontractors to provide services on the facility, and there was a change in the subcontractors, and there had been an African-American male working for one of the contractors, and when he became employed with a new contractor, he was not allowed to gain access to the BMW facility because of their BMW's policy on criminal convictions. And so he was denied employment by the subcontractor because he was not employable by BMW under their policy, and he'd worked for this previous contractor for a number of years on the premise, and the BMW policy basically was that if you had a conviction that was within 7 years, they would not deem you employable. And so this person basically was lost his position. EEOC charge was filed. EEOC pursued that, and basically EEOC's position was that it's a blanket exclusion. There wasn't any kind of individualized assessment that we talked about, the nature and gravity of the offense, the age of the convictions, although they did look at, 7 years, the previous contractor did, but EEOC did not. So it really got to the issue became those three components, the nature of the job, the recency, and the nature of the conviction. In the Dollar General case, the retailer had conditions on all of its job offers that there was a criminal background, that if you had some convictions within 10 years, you were not qualified for employment. And there was one prospective African-American applicant who had disclosed that they had a drug conviction that was 6 years old, and they were offered conditional employment by Dollar General, but then later the offer was revoked based on that policy of looking at disqualifying candidates for convictions that were, a decade old, 10 years. And there was another African-American worker, I believe, that was fired for a felony conviction that turned up during a background screen, but it was ultimately found to be untrue. And so Dollar General was forced to, validate the accuracy of a background screen, which raises another issue. You know, we've always been under the impression that if we have a harassment claim or discrimination claim presented to us through our grievance process, we're obligated to do an investigation. And the standard has always been to make the best decision we can based on the facts that we have at hand. We may not have all the facts. We may not have accurate facts. But the requirement is not that we make the right decision. We just make the best decision we can with the information that we have. And so that seemed to fly in the face of that Dollar General had information about a felony conviction on a background check that ultimately turned out to be untrue, and they were challenged on that. So now we have this introduction of a standard that we have to verify that what we're seeing is true from our third-party vendors. And so that raises another issue, and it's interesting. We talked a moment ago about some of the municipalities and states who passed these laws banning the box, so to speak, on the employment application. And I saw something very interesting in the Seattle law that was passed back in June of this year, where it says in this law in Seattle, Washington, that if you decide not to hire someone based on their conviction, you have to hold the position open for at least 2 business days after you notify the applicant of your decision to reject them. And the thought here is, or the purpose is, to give that individual the opportunity to correct or explain the information that you've used for making that decision. And that's just another bump in the road when it comes to being able to fill our positions quickly. And while there's no monetary penalties on that law, there's some civil penalties. So it's just getting more and more complex, the hurdles we have to jump through, not only from the EEOC, but some of these state and local laws that are being passed.
You're talking about two specific, Dollar General, BMW. And the EEOC came down, they filed the lawsuits. One of the questions I have is, in the ruling, Was there anything that tried to explain, again, I go back to common sense, right? Is there anything in the ruling that came down that said that the employer was okay, or that said the employer would be okay if they did it this way?
Yes. There's a case that was just decided in August. It was in the Federal District Court in Maryland, where the EEOC had brought a case against Freeman. It's a family-owned business that handles conventions and expositions and corporate events and meetings. If you've been to a conference, you've probably seen them setting up and tearing down the exhibition booth. And you know, they've got over 3,000 employees full-time, and I think 25 or 30,000 part-time workers for these conferences all across the United States. And so EEOC had filed suit against them, and this is really the slam against EEOC and this methodology of being very, very heavy-handed on this. So the case was filed against Freeman, and I think it was Judge Roger Titus that did summary judgment in favor of Freeman, and holding that EEOC's claim against the company, and this was what was so funny, it was a theory in search of facts to support it. It was just a fiasco from the beginning. The EEOC claimed that Freeman's facially neutral policy, meaning that they run criminal history checks and criminal background checks on prospective employees, that it violated Title VII just as it did in these others, and it had a discriminatory effect on African Americans and males, the same pattern that we're seeing. But what we saw in this case was that EEOC almost went to any length to win this case. They cherry-picked data. They used an unreliable expert witness that had been precluded from providing testimony in prior cases. And basically what the judge said is that, you know, indeed, any rational employer in the United States should really pause and think about what's happening here, that by bringing an action of this nature, what the EEOC is doing is giving him that Hobson's choice again of either ignoring criminal history and credit backgrounds and thus exposing themselves to potential liability for, you know, criminal acts or fraudulent acts by their employees and on the one hand, or incurring the wrath of EEOC for not utilizing the information that's deemed really fundamental by most any employer. You know, we need to know who we're hiring. And something far more than that, that this whole notion of this disparate impact claim that they were, that you know, this practice had a disparate impact on minorities and males, that to require less would cause you to have to throw out your common sense. And that's simply not what the discrimination laws of this country requires. And so it was really a smackdown of EEOC. And what came out in the summary judgment is that the judge criticized the EEOC because they, as an agency, do background screens on 90% of their own employees and couldn't offer an explanation as to how that differed. So this was really, I think, the telltale sign of what's to come. This was a major smackdown of EEOC, one that the WWF would be very proud of, and a judge who really gets it. The common sense entered into this that, you know, you say in your policy, do these three things, and yet this organization seems to be doing these things, but you're not even following your own advice. So we're not going to let you get away with it. And so I think this was a great victory for employers who are trying to do the right thing and trying to get some guidance. And so I think, you know, this will probably be appealed because it is a major embarrassment, I think, to the EEOC. But we'll just have to see where it goes from there.
Well, you know, provided a very good overview, and I think some of those examples really talk about the level of intrusion that is being done at this point and the contradictions to those intrusions.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WOLB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we've been having a great conversation with Charles Wilkinson, and Charles has been talking all about new information from the EEOC, the federal government, the states, the rules. I mean, all the rules and changes. But there's also something that, Charles, we haven't yet talked about, and I want to spend the last segment here on compensation, because compensation is very important, whether it's at the board level, whether it's at the C-suite level, whether it's really, frankly, at any level from line up. And there are rules and things that need to be looked at and some important things that employers and HR professionals need to be aware of. Can you provide a couple of those and things that they need to be aware of today?
If you're a nonprofit organization, compensation of your executives is very, very important. There's this IRS notion of reasonableness, that the compensation for executives has to be reasonable. And so it outlines some steps you'll need to take to make sure that it's reasonable, and that is having an independent body or committee that looks at compensation for the executives, that you use market data that's compiled for you or by you, that's from reliable sources, then that you rely upon that data for making your compensation decisions, and then that you document the rationale for the decision, not only the base compensation, but also the value of the benefits and any incentive compensation. And that will establish what's called this rebuttable presumption of reasonableness. So if you do those things, it's basically a safe harbor. If you can document it and prove that you've done it that way, then IRS is going to assume that it's reasonable. And when we deal with nonprofit organizations, often that's a new concept for them. It's a little bit concerning because it's such an important consideration for nonprofit organizations. And many times these are volunteer boards that are making executive compensation decisions. And there really are some major potential pitfalls to this. I mean, if it's not handled appropriately, if there's a distribution of profit, we saw one nonprofit where everybody's taking a percentage of their profits for the year and distributing that as a bonus. And on the face of it, that is a bad idea from the IRS's standpoint. So, you know, if there's excess compensation, the person receiving the compensation could have some excessive tax obligations. The body or the person's making the decisions could have some tax implications. So just a good idea to be aware of this rebuttable presumption if you're a nonprofit. Now, if you're a federal contractor, you're going to be audited by OFCCP, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, and there's been a lot of controversy in the arena of compensation. It's a big part of your affirmative action plan audit, and the guidelines are very fuzzy now because the standards we've been using since 2006 were rescinded in 2010, and they haven't really been replaced. And so what we see through audits is that the OFCCP is looking at your compensation by job title, by job group, that grouping of similarly situated employees, and they're looking for differences that are $2,000 or 2%, either or. You can fail one, you can fail them both, but they're looking at it by race and gender. So they'll look at the minorities versus the non-minorities, the males versus the females, the average rate of pay for those groups, and is there a difference greater than $2,000 or 2%? If there is, it's a red flag, and it prompts further audit review.
The reality is that, you know, a private organization should, correct me if I'm wrong, have the right to pay what they feel is necessary to attract and retain great talent. And so, you know, to be required to sometimes not necessarily do that seems wrong.
Well, it's one of those common sense issues again. And, you know, the markets change so often. You may have an employee that's been with you for 10 years, and at the time you hired them, they were at the top of the market. Well, the market's changed, and so the folks you're recruiting now may be significantly higher in compensation. And as long as you can explain the reason for the difference, because just the fact that there's a difference alone doesn't mean there's discrimination. And OFCCP in that audit situation would come back to you and say, we found a difference in this job group or job title, what have you. We need you to explain the reason for the difference. And so then the tables are turned. The burden of proof is back on the employer to say, well, its length of service with the company. It could be education level, experience level, licensure, certification. It could be performance. It could be a number of things that are legitimate business reasons for it that you could offer up. And if they would accept those, then you're okay. But it's when you can explain it. It's when you've got a female engineer who's been with you for 10 years, and all of a sudden all her male counterparts you've hired in recent years is making significantly more. They're doing the exact same job. You may even have some males with the same length of service. And so the question becomes, what do we do about this? We can't explain it. So that's when OFCCP would say, you know, take affirmative action, take initiative to correct the problem. If you can't explain it, or the factors you cite can't explain the full difference, then make some pay adjustments or what have you. Because particularly with females, we keep hearing this talk about the pay gap. And just like with the background screens and what EEOC says about the use of criminal background checks having a disparate impact on minorities and males, that, you know, the pay gap and a female's ability to negotiate perpetuates past discrimination. We hear that over and over, that a stereotypical comment that females don't negotiate as well as males do, so you're able to hire them at a lower rate, and they're always going to be behind. And so those are just issues you'll have to deal with as you look at your workforce. But EEOC, OFCCP and EEOC both expect that if someone's doing the same or similar job and all the other factors are same or similar, that they should be making the same or similar rate of pay.
Well, you know, that actually, of course, makes sense. And I think any employer would want to make sure that they're paying properly, and doing a proper compensation analysis is something that does need to be done to try to get and ensure that no matter what organization you have, that people are being paid fairly. Charles, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I think you provided a really in-depth analysis as to what's happening out there, especially for federal contractors and subcontractors. I truly appreciate you being on the show.
My pleasure.
And now your HR tip of the week. 9 Essential Skills for Human Resource Management. This is by Denise Rand, and she is on trendhr.com. There are 9 areas in which HR professionals assess candidates against a list of key skills and personal characteristics needed for the job. Here are what the 9 are. Organization, multitasking, dealing with gray issues, negotiation, communication, being discreet and ethical, being able to have a dual focus, conflict management and problem solving, and being able to deal effectively with change management. That's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be speaking with James Reedy. He is an employment attorney at Sheen, Finney, Bass & Green. And he's going to be talking about how to avoid the common problems with layoffs or RIFs. Also, he'll be discussing severance agreements, what you can and cannot do, and how employers should be very careful when it comes to dealing with letting employees go. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.